Aaron. All right. So this is session 342, Why Mormonism Can Abide Gay Marriage. The presenter is Brad Carmack, who is in his last year of the joint JD-MPA program at BYU. He's probably best known, maybe to this group, though, for his for being the author of Homosexuality, A Straight BYU Student's Perspective. And he's also a regularly participates in USGA, which is an unsponsored BYU student talk group. It stands for Understanding Same Gender Attraction. So I'll just turn it over to you.
Great, thanks. Everything kind of comes together at the same moment. I just walked in at the last, doing some book signings downstairs, and they're doing a It Gets Better campaign for gay Mormon youth, so I was doing a little recording there. Yeah, so this is my subject. I do have a lot of slideshow that have pictures and text. If you'd like to, you're welcome to come up a little bit closer to the screen, maybe kind of spread out. If you feel comfortable, yeah, that's fine, but if you want to, you're welcome to come up. I do want to get a little bit of audience awareness, so I'm going to ask you a little raise of hands, a couple of questions, just to discern how much you know. Of course, I'm also aware that there will be an eventual audio audience that will be larger than this one, so I'll try to keep them in mind as well. How many of you could give a pretty good definition for both intersex and transgender? If you could, raise your hand. Okay. If you've read at least one article dealing with acceptance of gay marriage within Mormonism, raise your hand. Okay. And 1 to 5, understanding the biology behind sexual orientation. If you're in the 1 to 5 range, then I'll ask if you're in the 6 to 10. If you're understanding...
Which is
so 0 is low. So 0, you don't really understand the biology of sexual orientation. 10, you're Simon LeVay and you're an expert. So 0 to 5? Okay, 6 to 10. Great. I appreciate that. That kind of helps me to tailor a little bit. I have a pretty ambitious schedule. I'll try to be clear. We'll pretty quick, though. First, we're going to talk a little bit about just briefly showing that the church is anti-gay marriage. I hope that's not a surprise to anybody. We'll talk about that briefly. I'm going to spend most of the presentation on outlines number 2 and 3. So we're going to talk about some of the consequentialist reasons. This is a moral argument that I'm making. So we're going to talk about some of the consequences or fruits of gay marriage. Gay marriage is a tree. What are the fruits? What are the consequences or results of gay marriage and Mormonism? And we'll also talk a little bit about the doctrine. Since I'm an active Mormon, a lot of Mormons are interested in, of course, Founding Proclamation and scriptures and how those textual sources bear in on the morality of the gay marriage question. And we'll have that little concluding slide. Okay? So this is a little procedure. Just a little about me. This is my my book I wrote last year. I was worried about getting kicked out of BYU because of it. It was halfway about gay marriage and halfway about the science of sexual orientation and how changeable sexual orientation and stuff like that is. I ended up being on the cover in February this year of Q Salt Lake. Come on in, everybody. You're welcome to come towards the front if you'd like. Q Salt Lake is a magazine, newspaper for the GLBT community in Salt Lake. And so I was pretty nervous about this, but I ended up not getting kicked out. I got my diploma a couple months ago. It's awesome. But that's just a little background. I'm straight myself. I kind of, most people that are straight who get involved in these issues have a family member or a friend that's gay that kind of is a trigger for them. For me, it wasn't. I was just kind of curious, and once I started researching, I realized what an important moral issue this was. And a few years ago, I didn't even know anybody that was gay. At least, I didn't think I did. I found out later, of course. We're going to come back to this couple. We'll circle around a little bit later. I just wanted to briefly introduce them. This is a couple who lives in Colorado, Taylor and Jessica. They've been dating for 1.5 years. They fell in love with each other, and they want to get married. Taylor and Jessica. And we'll talk a little bit more about Taylor in that situation a little bit later on. Okay, so first, talk a little bit about the church's anti-gay marriage stance. So this is an excerpt from the Church Handbook of Instructions, 2010. It's from the section on same-gender marriage, which there is such a section in Book 1 of the Church Handbook. And the church says, legal and lawful marriage only between a man and a woman. Pretty explicit opposition to gay marriage there. In that same section, they talk about the morality of sexual conduct and say that sexual conduct between those of the same gender is inappropriate and undermines the divinely created institution of the family. I'm going to argue against that proposition a little bit later on, but that's the language of the church handbook. This is the source of my title, which is Why Mormonism Can Abide Gay Marriage. The title of this is Why Mormonism Can't Abide Gay Marriage. There's an article written in Sunstone a few years ago by Chris Bigelow. So I'll respond to a few of his points there. You notice he has an equation of a man and a woman. A man plus a woman equals children. I realize the audio audience can't see the picture. But we'll talk about that argument as well. It's a common one that you hear in the context of gay marriage. Same-sex couples can't reproduce, so perhaps they should not be privileged to be married. We'll talk about that. Just briefly, we know the church has publicly opposed same-sex marriage legislation in Alaska, California, Hawaii. Nationally, they have the Founding Proclamation of 1995. And, of course, there's been a number of over-the-pulpit statements by church leaders condemning homosexual conduct. So, the church's anti-gay marriage stance is well-established. I realize it's a steep mountain that I'm trying to climb here, but I will make a strong effort to do so, and I think it's ultimately a successful trek, though it's a difficult one. But I'll let you be the judge of that by the end. So let's talk a little bit about the by-the-fruits arguments. Again, this is, if gay marriage is a tree, what are the fruits or consequences of gay marriage and Mormonism? We're just going to talk about what some of those consequences would likely be. Okay? It's a nice quote. I think Ron Scow, I think this is from his brother, Wayne, he says, Jesus taught us to evaluate attitudes and actions not by their conformity to the letter of a generalized law, but rather according to their compatibility with the spirit of love and the degree to which they promote self-development. So we are going to talk about doctrinal, scripture-based arguments for gay marriage within Mormonism, but first we're going to talk about the fruits. What are some of the common sense consequences of gay marriage? First one, the first fruit, that homosexual orientation can be about human love. Think about heterosexual orientation. It's a constellation of romantic, sexual, emotional desires and inclinations. And thus, like the heterosexual orientation that's common to most heterosexual marriages, that helps them to be stable, it helps to provide that interest in each other, that can provide immense human fulfillment. Homosexual orientation has that same capability, and that can be a basis for a stable marriage or a contributor to the stability of a marriage. So that's the first piece. It's valid human love. Question at the top. How does orientation buttress the stability of a relationship? So picture two women or two men that are in a relationship. How does their orientation help to make stability? Well, it's the same answer as for an opposite gender couple. That interest in companionship, in sex, in romance, those are consistent. They last for a long time. They help you to be interested in each other, and they help people to be bonded. Specifically, oxytocin is a neurochemical. It's the neurochemical that helps with human bonding. So, for instance, when a mother is nursing her child, she gets an oxytocin hit. It helps her to bond and love the child. Same thing with sex. There's a dopamine and an oxytocin release for both men and women that cause them to be melded and bonded together. So, of course, gay sex, just like straight sex, can help a marital couple be bonded to each other. Also, just a quick note here, of course, like opposite gender marriage, same-sex marriage is consensual. It needs to be limited to, of course, adults that consent to end the relationship. And so consent, of course, can help make a healthy and stable marital relationship. Got a nice picture here of a gay couple who have been together for over 50 years. The title there is Golden Years, Gay Couple Marks 50 Years Together. Of course, this couple probably wasn't married since most jurisdictions haven't allowed marriage for very long, but this would be no longer the exception. It could become more of the rule, as it is with opposite gender marriage. And we do know from the statistics and a lot of studies that marriages are, on average, more stable than cohabitation. This is likely to be true of gay relationships as it is of same or opposite gender relationships. Is there anybody having a hard time hearing at this point? Just want to check. Okay. Thanks again for attending. I appreciate your interest. Another reason, again, we're talking about the fruits of gay marriage, some of the reasons why gay marriage within Mormonism would be a good thing. Well, one of those reasons is there would be less celibacy. We consider ourselves in the church to be a pro-family church. And if ever there was an anti-family institution, that would be celibacy. And so having the option of gay marriage for gay people to have same-sex marriage but that can result in less celibacy. Less people that live their whole lives alone and instead form marital family relationships. Of course, you may know it's very difficult probably. I'm straight, so I don't know personally, but in the story that I read, being a predominantly and persistently homosexual-oriented individual, if you can, in good conscience, marry someone of the opposite sex, and but going into a same-sex relationship would result in losing your membership, most likely, it's a pretty tough choice. To choose to be alone your whole life or to have to risk your membership, something that for most of us to grow up in the church, we value highly. We value that spiritual and religious aspect of our lives. And of course, a lot of us have family members that will cause strained relationships if we leave. Okay, so we'll talk a little about the procreation argument. For the audio audience, I'm showing a picture from Chris Bigelow's Why Mormonism Can't Abide Gay Marriage. He's got a number of pictures. He's got a man plus several women equaling lots of children. He's got a man plus a woman equaling children. Then he's got a woman plus a woman equals question mark. begging the question of, well, same-sex couples can't reproduce. So there wouldn't be a basis for allowing them to marry, right? Because marriage is about procreation. That's sort of the general argument. Of course, a lot of scholars and, of course, common sense as well can come up with some rebuttals to this proposition fairly easily. But we know that marriage is and sex is more than just about procreation. Even the church handbook recognizes that sex is also about strengthening emotional and spiritual bonds between one spouse and the other spouse. It's not just about procreation. And as noted before, same-sex couples can have that same benefit of a sexual relationship through strengthening their marital bonds as can a straight couple. And also, of course, we allow all sorts of infertile couples to get married. There's a lot of people that are inherently infertile that have fertility problems. Or as I'll show in a picture, older people are generally very infertile, but we allow them to get married if they're opposite sex. It'll be a big surprise. So the procreation argument fails pretty quick. We could ask, this is a picture of a gay couple. They misunderstand the purpose of marriage. The purpose of marriage is to bear children, to reproduce naturally. Do they misunderstand? How about this couple? This is an older couple, and the female is definitely not fertile. I realize that there was one example in the scripture of an older lady producing. And I've noticed this in my book. I have a chapter about the ability of same-sex couples to reproduce. A lot of people, this is a bit of a surprise to them, but this is an article that came out in 2010. There's a mouse that has two, and only two biological parents, two male mice. How is this so? You might know that mice and humans share a lot of genetic material. If you were to take a cheek swab of me, on that cell you would have every genetic instruction needed to manufacture a human egg. So if I had a gay partner, you take that cell from me, you stimulate it to become pluripotent, go down to oogenesis and make an egg, it can be fertilized by my gay partner. You can have a child, a boy or a girl, and its only genes would come from me and my same-sex partner. So, a lot of people think same-sex couples can't reproduce. They've got everything they need to reproduce. It's just a technical problem. We have no problem with but opposite-sex couples, we allow them to do reproductive technologies when they have difficulties with their fertility, and we have no problems with letting them bear children through reproductive technologies. In a very literal and biological way, same-sex couples just need some reproductive help, as do infertile opposite-sex couples. There's nothing inherent about same-sex couples that are non-reproductive. All you need is genes. They've got all the genes they need. Okay, let's talk a little more about the common sense benefits of marriage. You know, compared to unmarried people, married people live longer, they're more productive, they have higher incomes, fewer problems with alcohol, less depression. There's a much longer list. But we kind of know intuitively that married people on average compared to unmarried people have all these benefits. So why would this support gay marriage in the church? Well, we want our gay people that are members of the church to experience these same benefits. We have no interest in having people that are members of our communities have less access to benefits than others without good reason. We want people to be married and have these benefits. It applies to gay people the same as it applies to straight people. Another good point. same-sex couples can parent. We know that to bring a child up into a healthy adult, it not only must be born, it must also be raised. Same-sex couples can do a stellar job of raising children. And not only the parents in same-sex couple relationships, but also the children stand to benefit from having their gay parents be married compared to cohabiting. You know that children cohabiting with cohabiting parents have more crime, more alcohol, depression, less education, etc. They stand to gain from marriage compared to cohabitation the same as children of straight couples. That's another important reason, another important fruit. There's a couple pictures. There's not a lot of research out there yet, but some seems to indicate that same-sex couples parent as well or better in terms of child outcomes as opposite-gender parents. In my opinion, this next fruit, I've entitled it Providing Reliable Caregivers, is the number one reason why Mormonism can abide gay marriage. And it's because if marriage means anything in our culture, right, there's a number of norms of marriage, fidelity, having children, etc. But the strongest norm is that spouse A takes care of spouse B, and spouse B takes care of spouse A. There's a great quote here from Jonathan Rauch. He wrote Gay Marriage, Why It's Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America. He says, a husband or wife is a social worker of first resort, a psychiatrist of first resort, a cop, and counselor, an insurer, a nurse, a 911 operator of first resort. Think about all these people that aren't married. Who's taking care of them? And think about the potential of that person to take care of a spouse. Society benefits incredibly from marriage in that way of caretaking. And when they don't get taken care of, they either get neglected or the state picks up the tab or the family. That's why another huge reason why marriage in an economic and social way is so useful and valuable to society. And that includes our Mormon communities. Another good reason. You may know that young men are strong, they're energetic, they're testosterone-y, and they need some civilizing. They need to be socialized, just like children do. And when they aren't, there are some problems. And this is kind of common wisdom, but we know that marriage is the best institution, or at least among the best, for civilizing young men. The stat here says unmarried men between 25 and 24 and 35 are three times as likely to murder another male, more likely to rape and rob, and they have all sorts of other risks compared to their married counterparts. This applies to gay people, it applies to straight people. And so having these gay men have the option of marriage compared to celibacy could bring great benefit to our Mormon communities. Another fruit. You may be aware that the trend recently tipped the scales of being the majority in America in support of gay marriage. The trend around the world and in America is towards acceptance of gay relationships. And so, of course, that will make some similar to how there was acceptance of abolishing racism. It caused a lot of tension when we had a policy at the church that wouldn't give the priesthood to black people. It was a clearly racist policy. So over time, as that trend of public opinion diverged more and more from the practice of the church, that caused increasing tension. And so even though it was a little bit late in some people's opinions over a decade after the civil rights movement, imagine if today we still had that priesthood ban, the intensity of the public opposition. So the point here is certainly a reversal of saying that Mormons now accept gay marriage wouldn't look very consistent, so you lose points there. But in the long term, as that trend continues to depart from the church practice, it's going to cause increasing tension. And so the church itself stands to gain from some public policy points or public opinion by accepting gay marriage. And again, my commitment is to leave a few minutes at the end for Q&A, but I'm going to keep on going here. Again, we're here in the fruit section, looking about the consequences of gay marriage. There's a lot of church members that are likely to be relieved if gay marriage is accepted in the church. Why? Well, think of the men that sit on those disciplinary councils that excommunicate people based on homosexual issues or people that enter gay relationships. Imagine that some of them are pretty anguished about that decision, especially if they know the person who's a faithful, who's a spiritual, who's a consistent member of the congregation. Having to excommunicate that person because they choose to live a life that's not celibate, that fits with their orientation, we stand to gain by removing that anguish. Additionally, of course, there's a lot of gay people that would be very relieved by this. It would signal acceptance and acknowledgement of the reality of homosexual orientation and send that powerful message that there can be value from having these gay marriages accepted as part of our communities. And so there'll be less people that have to live double lives. There's a lot of men and women in the church right now who are gay, who are married to an opposite sex spouse with varying degrees of success. But a lot of them are living a double life. A lot of them are in the closet. A lot of them hide their orientation. A lot of them are stressed and have incredible anxiety and problems associated with having to maintain this facade and pretending to be straight when they're not. So we stand to gain from relieving them. Of course, gay youth, gay members of the church, can have less despair about their future, their self-worth, their belonging. They don't have to worry about being excommunicated. They have the same standard as straight people, which is sex inside marriage and not outside of it. Instead of sex, never. Relationships, never. They can have hope about their future and less despair about rejection from their family and from their church leaders and community. Although I don't have any gay members of my family, and although, of course, I've realized the last couple of years when I started looking at these issues, I have a lot of friends that are gay. Didn't realize that a few years ago. But a lot of us that are the family members of gay people, the spouses or the children, they stand to gain as well. Because children can come into families where the parents don't have this type of a conflict. They can come into families where their parents are married rather than cohabiting. Because same-sex couples are going to happen, whether or not gay marriage is accepted in the church. We want those gay couples to be excommunicated and the children of those same-sex couples out of the church. We want the children of those same-sex couples in the nourishing fold and arms of the church congregations. I, as many others, would argue the latter. And that leads me to another point, looking at the numbers. We're going to have more people in the fold. The majority of people that are gay, by the time they're 80 years old, have left the fold. And usually it's not unrelated to their orientation and different consequences of their orientation. I also think, I know of a professor at BYU, his son refused to go on a mission. Although he believed in the church, he felt that going on a mission would say, I endorse the views of the church. And he couldn't in good conscience endorse the views of the church on homosexuality, so he refused to serve. And of course, there are other members that have left the church over this issue. Acceptance of gay marriage would probably lessen or mitigate that reality. Another fruit here that's sort of along the same lines, more sheep in the fold. As mentioned before, the children of these same-sex couples will remain in the church because their parents are in the church rather than outside of it. And of course, there are some converts troubled by this issue who won't join who otherwise would. So there are going to be at least some of those. This is a very compelling reason or fruit to justify or support having gay marriage in the church. Parents. Parents generally want their children to marry. They want their children to be happy. They want their children to have the opportunity to have a healthy, stable relationship. They don't usually want their children to enter risky mixed orientation marriages, which, although some are successful by most measures of marital success, they have special difficulties. And if some of you in this room probably know some individuals in mixed orientation marriages, either they're still together or they're divorced, it can be very difficult. And parents generally want their kids to have the best chance they can for a healthy, long-term relationship. So a lot of them don't want their gay children to get into risky mixed orientation marriages, either the straight spouse or the gay spouse. Think about if you're a parent, if you'd want your child who's straight to marry somebody who's gay, you may not understand what that means. But parents want their gay children to have a robust opportunity for stable marriage. This is almost the exact same slide, but instead of looking at the parents, it looks at the children. Gay people generally, of course, are going to be concerned about risking entering into a risk mixed orientation marriage, and very few of them want to stay celibate for life. I got this picture. Imagine a whole lifetime of lonely dinners, which is the fate of some gay people in the church. So this is kind of the conclusion. Again, this is the second portion. We talked about the fruits or the consequences of gay marriage. Got the Savior teaching that thing about fruits. I'll leave it up to you to decide if the fruits are good or bad. We've gone over about a dozen different fruits or consequences of having gay marriage in the church. Now we're going to turn to doctrinal arguments based on Scripture and the Founding Proclamation. Okay, so when I talk about gay marriage, a lot of times my friends that are mainstream church members, somewhat like myself, I guess I'm not quite mainstream, but I'm active, normal believing, I guess. But anyway, they oftentimes bring up the Founding Proclamation. Of course, the Founding Proclamation says, marriage between a man and a woman is ordained of God. However, let me suggest to you four possible reasons why the Founding Proclamation does not, in effect, forbid same-sex marriage in the church. The first reason, the Founding Proclamation is not doctrine. There's a quote here from President Lee: the only one authorized to bring forth any new doctrine is the president of the church. And then there are three requirements. When he does it, he will declare it a revelation from God, it will be so accepted by the Council of the Twelve, and it will be sustained by the body of the church. Think about the Founding Proclamation. Does it fit those three? The body of the church sustained it?
No.
Now, this could be a whole discussion itself, what qualifies as doctrine.
Sorry, guys.
Get that turned off. In the LDS church, but we don't have time for that. But that's the first reason. It's not doctrine. It was put forth by the Council of the Twelve and not accepted by the church. So you think about, by comparison, Manifesto about polygamy in 1890, that was accepted by the body of the church, as was the 1978 lifting of the priesthood ban. The Founding Proclamation doesn't qualify. Reason number two of four. On its face, it doesn't actually forbid or prohibit same-sex marriage. It says marriage between a man and woman is ordained of God. By way of comparison, the logic here, after a square is a quadrilateral, but that doesn't preclude a rectangle from also being a quadrilateral. Okay? So linguistically, as it says here, it's not a limitation, it's a description. You can still have marriage between a man and a woman. Accepting gay marriage does not destroy that reality. Marriage is still between a man and a woman, even if it was also between a woman and a woman, or a man and a woman. That's reason number two. Reason number three, and I'm not the first to notice this, but the Founding Proclamation does have an exception clause. It says disability, death, or other circumstance may necessitate individual adaptation. Well, I would claim this is my suggestion, a persistent predominant homosexual orientation. Thank you. If ever there was one. So that's reason number three. Okay, so I've suggested three out of four possible reasons why the Founding Proclamation does not forbid same-sex marriage in the church. The fourth one's a little bit longer, but stay with me on it. The construction of gender doesn't say sex in the Founding Proclamation, although I think that's probably what it means. Because gender is sort of a psychological reality. Sex is typically a biological one. But it talks about gender in an explicitly spiritual sense and in an explicitly non-physical sense. Why do I claim this? Here's the clause. Gender is an essential characteristic. Remember that, so we'll come back to that. An essential characteristic of individual premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose. And what do we know from modern theology about premortality? We were only spirits then. We didn't have physical bodies. We didn't have mortal bodies like we now do. That means, and this is my syllogism here, that at least in this clause, and probably in the entire proclamation, they're talking about spiritual gender. And they're talking about male and female, man and woman. Why does this matter? We're going to come back to this claim it a bit. You can't measure shoe size with a thermometer. What does this mean? Well, how do you tell somebody's spiritual gender? If I had a nice little curtain here and I brought somebody in behind them, can you tell me whether their spirit was a male or a female? We're going to get into this a little bit more. Just so you know, some of these pictures, I'm a biologist, I'm kind of familiar with anatomy, but I realize not everybody's has a stomach for it, so you may want to turn away with some of these pictures, just to warn you. It won't be too bad, but common sense question. How do we tell somebody is a boy or a girl? I think the common sense answer is, how do they look? They look like a boy. They look like a girl. You know, how long is their hair? How, you know, muscly are they? Do they have breasts? That kind of thing. It's pretty common sense, right? So when we're determining male and female, we look at appearance. It's not a surprise, but it has some interesting implications. What about when you can't tell? This is the famous Pat from SNL sketch. The point of the sketch is that People have a difficult time telling if Pat's a male or a female. Even when Pat speaks, it's still difficult to tell. So, I remember I asked my dad one time, how do you tell if a cat is a boy or a girl? He says, well, it's the same way that you tell if a person's a boy or a girl. And I kept on pressing him, well, how do you tell that? He's like, well, pull down your pants, then you can tell. And it's like, So, if the appearance doesn't say, and this is a serious argument here, there's a few different ways that we tend to think of what defines gender. How do we discern if somebody's a boy or a girl? Well, we can look at their genitalia, we can look at their genes, we can look at their gametes, see if they make sperm or eggs. We're going to explore each of these briefly in turn. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about sex determination. There was a great speech about a decade ago by Dwayne Jeffrey here at Sunstone talking about intersex issues and how an embryo goes from male to female. We're not going to do, he did it in 90 minutes, we're going to cover the same thing in about three. But I'll talk about why this is relevant. Just kind of keep a broad picture level, you don't have to understand the details here. But just to show how a human embryo, which at conception is not male or female, turns later on down the road into a physical male or a physical female. So we know there's XX and XY. Turns out about 1 in 1,700 people is neither XX nor XY. They're X nothing, or XXY, or XYY, or something like that. But typically, the reason this genotype, XY or XX, changes an embryo, which at 5 weeks is bipotential. It can be a male or a female. The default path is female. But the SRY gene, it's on the Y chromosome for the male, it creates a protein, has a cascade of effects that makes this default embryo go down the path of male development. Now, sexual orientation is a subset of the development of the brain. The male and female brain are different. And if something in that process, that cascade, doesn't go exactly right, you maintain the default sexual orientation, which is the female type. It's an orientation towards men. So, knowing that, you would probably guess that men are going to have a little higher incidence of homosexuality in men than in women, because there's more steps that can go wrong. This is the default path, right? The default orientation is toward men. What do we observe? At 1.5 to 2 times as many gay men as lesbian women. Anyway, so you've got this bipotential phase, male or female. The SRY gene, it's on the Y chromosome, makes a protein that causes that bipotential embryo to go down the male path. You've got, a piece of paper. Wonderful visual. So, in embryonic development, you make plates or sheets of cells. In order to make a tube, they curl up on each other, kind of zip down the line. This makes a tube. Well, they have the same plate of cells that's a predicate for both male and female genitalia. So you've got the same plate, which in one case will become a scrotum for the male, will become the labia majora in the female. Similarly, they have another plate, which will become either the urethra in the male, and fully tube up, or it will become the labia minora in the female. And the reason you made it is kind of like a slit thing. It doesn't fold up all the way, or only folds up on the corners. It's sort of a slit in the middle. That's the reason for what we observe in the difference between male and female genitalia. Let me get a picture here for you. So I got a picture here. It's called the midline. So when that plate of cells comes together, this midline is the thing in the middle. So sometimes you have people where it closes part way. So you have a partial penis and a partial vagina. Okay, so you've got people that have both of these genital types. And remember, this is a way to discern physical gender. So what do you do when somebody's midline is partial? So you've got a partial vagina, partial penis. Is it a male? Is it a female? Does it matter how far along the midline that they connect? It's a difficult question. Okay, so here we have a picture of a genetic male who, of course, looks like a female. It's AIS, androgen insensitivity syndrome. We'll get into the details. Again, the broad picture here, the point is that nature doesn't draw lines on us. We draw lines on nature. Male and female is not a black and white category in nature. So here's a summary. We've got that bipotential embryo. Comes either male or female. Female is the default. And when you've got anything that goes abnormal in this process, you've got people with both genitalia, you've got people that look like women but genetically are male, and vice versa, and everything in between. A nice quote here from Samuel: "Look not on his countenance, on the height of his stature, for the man looketh on the outward appearance." And indeed, we do when it comes to gender. We look on the outward appearance, which is ambiguous. And here's, I'll bring it home to relevance here pretty soon. So we did the pull the pants down test. Genitalia doesn't really put everybody into buckets, male or female, so we can't depend on genitalia to determine boys and girls. This is, again, more people that have both male and female parts. You got people that are hermaphrodites, that have genitalia of both, you know, breasts and a penis, for instance. This is a picture. Sometimes you've got testicles where the ovary should be. Sometimes the ovary slash testicles descend into a scrotum-like sac. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes one of them do. You basically get every variety under the sun. That's the bottom line. So, this works out in real life. These are two runners. You may have heard this story. The one on the right set a record in the female race. And somebody started to ask, is this person really a girl? And so, it turns out, this individual is genetically male. But this individual looks entirely like a female. One of those intersex people, right? You probably can't see all these stats, but as I mentioned before, about 1 in 1,700 people are neither XX nor XY when they're born. And one out of every 100 births, their bodies differ from the standard male and female. This is not an uncommon phenomenon. But again, I'm not lecturing on intersex issues here, but I'm going to bring home why this matters. So we know that the genetics test and the gametes test doesn't work either because we have intersex aberrations. Because remember, the family proclamation, an essential characteristic. It must be male or female. And so if you have an unambiguous gender before this life, and you're interested in getting males and females only together in marriage, you've got to have an unambiguous test for determining male and female when they come before you. I'll illustrate this. Okay, so Pat's asking why does this matter? Most people are pretty clearly male or female, so you make a special test for the fringe cases, right? If you look at people that are clearly male or female, you can discern those. There's a little story here. I'll go ahead and read it. You're probably familiar with the talk. Years ago, I visited a school in Albuquerque. The teacher told me about a youngster who brought a kitten to class. As you can imagine, that disrupted everything. She had him hold the kitten up in front of the class. It went pretty well until the children said, is it a boy kitty or a girl kitty? Similar to my question to my dad a long time ago. Didn't want to get into the lesson, so the teacher said, doesn't matter, it's just a cat. And they said, no, no. And one boy said, I know how you can tell. And the teacher said, how? How do you tell? The student says, you can vote on it. As President Packer predicted, you laughed at the story. But, and here's the point here, this is the laughter down, the seriousness in. He says a vote could somehow alter the designs of God's laws and nature, a law against nature would be impossible to enforce. So, all those that laughed, let's vote. I'm going to give you two people. You can say male or female. I'll have you raise your hand. First on the left. Remember, this is the genetic male, and it looks like a female. How many say it's a girl? How many say it's a guy? How many people are shaking their head? I don't know. Thank you. Okay. Same thing with the person on the right. So the bottom line is, we don't know an individual's spiritual sex. Take a look at that baby. What's the height of that person's spirit? Take a look at this legless man. What's the shoe size of that person's spirit? You see, physical sex is ambiguous. If spiritual sex is unambiguous, then physical sex or appearance cannot be the basis for determining what couple gets married and what couple does not get married under the family proclamation. Okay? Hence my phrase, you can't measure shoe size with a thermometer. You can't measure spiritual gender by physical appearance. This is crucial. Again, this is the fourth reason why the Founding Proclamation doesn't necessarily forbid same-sex marriage. So imagine you're a bishop. You've got a couple that comes before you. Remember, this is the Colorado couple. They're in love. They want to get married. They've been dating for a year and a half. They're both members of the church. They want the bishop to marry them. Does the bishop say yes? Or does he say no? Well, what if it was the runner, who's genetically male, but looks like a woman? Imagine yourself as the bishop. Do you marry the couple? Or do you not marry the couple? And when I first introduced this couple, there was no image. I wonder, did you think of this? Or did you think of this? A Taylor goes both ways. I have a friend named Taylor who's a boy, and I have a friend named Taylor who's a girl. It can go either direction. I imagine most of you probably thought of that. But Taylor is also a girl's name. So, for the bishop, which of these do you marry? Which of them do you not? It's a pretty big difference, wouldn't you say? You marry the one on the left, intended for exaltation. The one on the right, intended for excommunication. And this is the bottom line, this is the main point, this is the take-home message. It's not just the fringe cases, because everybody is a fringe case, if you can't tell, right? The entire criterion of physical appearance has to be rejected if you're trying to determine what spiritual sex a person is. You cannot rely on the physical appearance, and that's the point. So, if you're uncertain about spiritual sex, and you're the bishop, you can do one of two things. You can marry all the couples that come in front of you, or you can marry none of them. It doesn't make sense to marry only some of them. Logically, it doesn't make sense. And of course, there's the less technical and more down-to-earth question. I would say, and I think most people probably agree, that a person's fate at the judgment bar should be based on the morality of their behavior, not on how much of a hormone was present in the womb to make an embryo go down one path or the other. Same-sex couples, they can love their spouses. Same-sex couples can abuse their spouses. Opposite-sex couples can love or abuse their spouses. Doctrine and Covenants 29 says that, I'll just read the second verse. Behold, I gave unto him that he should be an agent unto himself. I gave unto him a commandment, but no temporal commandment. Gave I unto him, for my commandments are spiritual. They are not natural nor temporal, neither carnal nor sensual. Doctrine and Covenants 29. So just a reminder, we've talked mostly about the family proclamation. We're still hearing the doctrinal arguments. We're going to talk about some scriptures and some other doctrinal bases, okay? So the restoration scriptures, you can look at them really hard. You have to find a lot about homosexuality and same-sex marriage in the restoration scriptures, but the Mormon, Pearl of Great Price, Doctrine and Covenants. They're not there. Some would say that omission is pretty significant. The Book of Mormon was written for our day, and we seem to have a lot of hullabaloo about this set of issues in modern-day society, but there's nothing there in the Restoration Scriptures. There are a few verses commonly cited from the Bible. And Chris Bigelow in Why Mormonism Can't Abide Gay Marriage talked about some of those. There have been other presentations on these scriptures, so I'm not going to get into the analysis there, except to say that none of them, alone or together, unequivocally support the proposition that the Bible condemns homosexuality. And there's all sorts of papers written about this. My book, I've got 600 footnotes. I've got all sorts of analysis on everything I talked about, pretty much. You can see some of the more detailed analysis of the scriptures there if you're interested. Suffice it to say, there are some scriptures there that don't support the proposition compellingly. Okay, so the Church Handbook of Instructions. Let's look at the law of chastity. It's binding in the church. It says that only those that are legally and lawfully wedded can have sexual relations. Well, interestingly, unlike the Word of Wisdom, unlike a lot of other standards in the church, the law of chastity is tied to an external legal concept. You don't have to be married by the bishop. You don't have to be married in the temple to make sexual relations to be moral rather than immoral. You just have to be legally and lawfully married. So arguably, same-sex couples that are legally and lawfully married are already abiding the law of chastity because they're keeping their sexual relations within their marital, legal, and lawful relationship. So it wouldn't take a huge extension to have same-sex marriage accepted in the church and be able to preserve the law of chastity. I acknowledge on its face it's only to men and women right now. There's no getting around that. However, it wouldn't be a very big extension. Another argument, a lot of positions have been reversed in the church. It used to be necessary to have a polygamous relationship to be able to make it to exaltation. Again, there's been whole presentations on these subjects. Also, in 1949, the First Presidency Statement says, it's not a matter of the declaration of policy, but of direct commandment from the Lord, founded upon which is founded the doctrine of the church. That's why we don't give the priesthood to black people. It's not a practice. It's a doctrine. We don't have a whole lot of, most of us don't have a hard time in rejecting that as a doctrinal position.
Where is that from?
I've got it written down on my thing, but I can't see it on the screen. It's from, this one is 1949, it was August 17th, 1949, First Presidency Statement, for the second one. And the first one's from Brigham Young Journal of Discourses. And again, you can look at all my sources they're exhausted and stuff like that in my book. So the bottom line, doctrinal positions can be either interpreted or changed. I have 1, 2, 3 here. I'm not saying that it will necessarily, but it certainly could. The church could accept gay marriage. It's done reversals in the past that made a lot of sense. I think this one makes a lot of sense as well. It might be the next one. Who knows? All right. Church handbook. As cited earlier, explicitly anti-gay marriage. However, like the founding proclamation, the church handbook is not doctrine. Now, this is another argument from Chris. I wish I could get on the blackboard. Like, I almost didn't include it because I don't think it's that strong of an argument. But because it was in his Why Mormons Are Can't Abide Gay Marriage, I decided to put it up. Is this it? Yeah. So it says, God has a penis, so you've got to use it in godlike ways. You can't imagine God doing gay sex, so the logic there is that you can't accept it in Mormon theology. I'll admit, I'm a straight person, I think gay sex is pretty gross. But I don't think that's a basis to say that it wouldn't fit in our theology. This is a good quote from Bill Bradshaw. It says, unable to imagine themselves engaging in such activity, heterosexuals perceive it to be unnatural, to be a perversion. But since this is deemed a private matter, the mechanics of lovemaking are neither prescribed nor proscribed. Thoughtfulness and sensitivity to the feelings of one's mate being the most important consideration. So again, I hope people inquire what I do in the bedroom. As far as between a gay couple or gay sex, I'm not persuaded. It's up to you, of course, to make your decision by this basis of gay sex being gross, so it can't fit into LDS theology. Also, I've had my relatives that have kind of countered me on Facebook and stuff. They say, well, there's no same-sex couples in heaven, so we're doing people a disservice by getting married here. I would note that God either is monogamous or polygamous, and there's a lot of Mormons that have died monogamous, and a lot of Mormons that have died polygamous. So if you have to become the way that God is, one or the other group has got some changing to do. You've got some spouses to add, or some spouses to lose, or something. Or the other scenario, of course, is that there's both monogamous and polygamous relationships in heaven, in which case, if that's true, there's at least some level of marriage diversity, right? So there could be some diversity along the gender axis, as well as the number of partners axis. And also, we have no evidence that there's an appeal to ignorance doesn't establish the point, but we don't have any evidence against there being same-sex couples in the celestial kingdom that I'm aware of. I thought this was interesting. I thought this a couple weeks ago. The best example we have of the intersection of love, commitment, and unity is not between a male and a female that are married. It's between three men. Namely, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. Men, and I would say women and women too, can have very intimate, loving, caring, committed relationships. Also, some people say, well, there's just something about women and males and males. If they can't create physical children, then they won't be able to create spiritual children, is how the syllogism goes. I would note that we really don't know how spiritual reproduction occurs. I would say that if countless inhabitants of millions and biscillions of worlds are inhabited by God's begotten sons and daughters, as I say up here, people are laughing. The audio audience doesn't know why. It's because the slide says that God has an obscene amount of sex, if that's the mechanism. We do know that in other forms of creation, God breathes in spirit and creates things from the dust. We just don't know, really, how spiritual reproduction takes place, so it's not a good basis to prohibit gay marriage. How much time do I got, Sam? Oh, perfect. We're on good time. So here's an analogy. So this is a woman. This is her first husband. She got married. 3 weeks after they got married, he got killed in a car crash. And so the question is, what's the fate of the woman? So if she got sealed to husband one, it would be unfair to deprive, as it were, husband one of his wife. He did nothing wrong. He kept his covenants faithfully for 3 weeks, right? But we ask the woman, we ask her to be single for the rest of her life? Do the men in the church, do we say, don't go after her, go after somebody you can get sealed to? You don't want to get to heaven and be sealed to no one, right? So, we encourage the men in the church to consider dating her. We consider her not to stay single. We ask and encourage her to get married. This is hugely significant. What's going to happen in the afterlife? Will she be sealed to husband one? If she be still the husband too, will the children be sealed to marriage one? Will the children be married sealed to marriage two? Will husband one or husband two lose his spouse in the afterlife? Again, I think this is one of those answers or questions that we just don't know the answer to. It's kind of like we don't always know the spiritual sex based on appearance. We don't know the answer to this question. That's my assertion. Maybe some of you know the answer. But I think we have no problem encouraging this woman to marry, encouraging men to date her, and to marry her, and to raise children with her. If we don't know how it's going to turn out in the resurrection, and we still encourage this, why not encourage gay marriage based on that same faith that it'll be worked out somehow? Okay, so we've talked about the church's anti-gay marriage stance. We've talked about the fruits or consequences of gay marriage and Mormonism. I left it up to you to decide if they were good or evil fruits. I've made some robust doctrinal-based arguments based on the scriptures, family proclamation, church handbook, and afterlife eschatology sort of considerations. To conclude, Mormonism can abide gay marriage. You're welcome to read my book. You can buy it here, or you can get it for free, PDF on my blog. It's bradcarmack.blogspot.com, bradcarmack.blogspot.com. You're welcome to email me if you want my PowerPoint presentation, or if you'd like me to email you my book. My email is bradleycarmack@gmail.com, bradleycarmack@gmail.com. And, with perfect timing, Q&A.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
With this argument about spiritual gender, how does that work into Mormonism with the fact that we are only ordained men to the priesthood? Are you envisioning like a total reworking of that as well?
Yeah, I thought about that. I thought that question might come up. Because, of course, casting down on that, I mean, there's an entire sequence, both in Mormonism and outside of it, of gender roles. And interesting, I almost put up a, in fact, I have a slide a little bit later here. There's a Day Universe article that came out recently about a preschool that's gender neutral. It's in, I think, Northern Europe somewhere. And they have, they call the children, instead of like by pronouns he and her, they made up a new one that was neutral somehow. And they avoid enforcing gender roles, you know, with the boys with the sticks playing around and things like that. And there's another article talking about the end of gender. The short and unsatisfying answer is, I don't know, because the implications do seem to be pretty wide beyond this narrow field of gay marriage, if in fact spiritual gender can't be affirmed. Although it is possible to affirm some gender roles based on physical sex that aren't based on spiritual ones. But I would also question some of the significance of the gender roles that aren't well-based. Like, I think that some gender roles, for instance, taking a birth control pill might make a lot more sense if you're a girl than a boy. There are some, if you have a need, you know, a uterus and a fallopian tube, then there are certain drugs that will be relevant to that. But other gender roles that aren't biologically based don't make as much sense. And of course, as a society, we've largely rejected traditional stereotypes and gender roles in regards to legal privileges and marital rights. Thanks. We're all one and two.
I'm worried about being excommunicated.
The question is, am I worried about being excommunicated? Yes, a little bit. I'd like to stay in the church. But I've had a really rich feeling of education, a rich heritage in the church. I felt kind of called to speak on this issue, and I think God would prefer that I speak from my heart rather than not.
Good for you.
Thanks.
One of my favorite lines that I ever invented is that sexism and homophobia are the twin relics of patriarchy.
Sure.
And that when we do something about one, we're going to do something about the other, so then we won't have to worry about who we ordain, because we can ordain everybody.
Right, I'd like to suggest that the church already abides gay marriage. I think my wife may be actually a male. So there you have it.
Yes.
Do you see the church, I mean, already is kind of pulling back a little bit on its political opposition somewhat, and do you see maybe gradual change or something more like stays the same for a long time, and then there's a revelation. I mean, like, there could be steps where first you'd accept it legally.
Sure.
And then you'd have bishops performing marriages. And then maybe it could be marriage for time. I don't know.
Sure, yeah.
Temple. I mean, what could you possibly imagine?
Either scenario is feasible. I mean, there are already some bishops that allow gay couples to come without excommunicating them. There are other bishops that almost immediately excommunicate them, or some that do some sort of intermediate discipline. It's certainly feasible you could go time only at first, or even stop there. I find it difficult to forecast, but either route is possible. I think we had a second back there, yeah.
One of the concerns about children in same-sex marriages is you may condition the children towards lifestyle.
Yeah, the question is about whether or not, for instance, children raised in same-sex relationships will turn out themselves gay. There was a little bit of research. I think that there is a slight increase in identifying as lesbian for children raised in lesbian relationships. Other than, and that's a modest one. The other ones are pretty much the same. I mean, as you would expect, since there's a biological origin for both heterosexuality and homosexual orientation, children, irrespective of their orientation with parents, are usually going to identify with the orientation that they're born with, which doesn't seem to vary a lot based on if the parents are straight or gay. And of course, anecdotally, we realize that most gay people have two straight parents. It seems to work in the direction as well. Yes?
Your presentation is so much common sense and reasonable for the
I'm glad it struck you that way. I think so too.
Any suggestions as to how ordinary people, everyone else, could help the church move more in this direction other than distributing all your material to authorities?
Right. Yeah, how can ordinary people? I guess part normal answer is about talking about it, writing about it, talking to people, developing some of the arguments yourself. You can have, you know, 4 or 5 points probably that you can talk about. If you have a same-sex couple that you know and love, if you can introduce those kind of people, that's a huge persuader right there. I mean, once people know a healthy same-sex couple, it really helps change minds. Thanks. Yeah?
Have you ever presented this to any general authorities or anyone in the hierarchy?
No, I think I had a friend of mine that gave my book to somebody in church media or something like that, but not really. Good question. I'd love if one was interested in it. I put a lot of research together, you know, 600 footnotes. I looked at a lot of the stuff in the last couple of decades. There's other Mormon scholars that have made a lot of these arguments. Some of them are unique as far as I know, but most of them are ones that others have made. But it's nice to kind of put it all together. I think that some authorities are aware of a lot of the arguments, but short answer to your question, no.
With a name like Carmack, are you related to a general authority?
Yeah, am I related? I do have a great uncle who was a general authority. He's emeritus now. Yeah.
Which was it? Who's
that? John Carmack, yeah. My grandpa Cecil's brother. Last question? We have time for one last one.
What's the name of your book?
My book is Homosexuality, a Straight BYU Student's Perspective. That one doesn't count.
With regards to the fruits point that you were making, what would you make of an argument, for example, say that the church does embrace same-sex marriage and there grows a split, like in the Anglican Church, for instance? What would you say to a critique of that sort?
Okay, so like the concern if some of the members
would split, or instead of gaining members, it would actually lose its
own. Yeah, that's definitely possible. And we see, I think, similar scenarios in other faiths. Of course, we had probably some split when there was polygamy, and we know there was one there, right? And there's blacks and priesthood, so that's pretty common. And that's certainly something to consider. There are consequences for having schisms like that in the church. But there's a schism happening already. If we don't move that direction, there already is an exodus from the church based on this issue.
I was going to respond to that, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Many of the other churches have battled with that issue. Have some of the solution for that is they allow each congregation or area on its own to find their position over a period of time. So gradually, every church, every congregation moves in that direction, but they allow this kind of
ease into it.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
Great.
That's a possible solution.
I'll take my books. I'm going to go outside because we have to get out for the next group. But we can turn the lights on, and thanks again. Yeah.